Okay, so welcome to week four of the four-week series on the worldly winds. So, firstly, I'm introducing a new feature, which is a loyalty card. So if you have attended all 4 weeks, it does entitle you to a free hot beverage. So, so you can collect that during tea break if you'd like to. So we've covered quite a lot of ground, as you can, as you probably remember if you have been here. So we've looked at the spiritual attainments of cats, we've looked at the karma of Cocoa Pops, and lots of other stuff as well. So unfortunately, Stephen, who hasn't been to any of the talks so far, is going to be a bit bewildered by that introduction, I'm afraid. So let's press on then. So tonight's talk is entitled, "It's All About Me." So I don't mean, obviously, it's all about me, literally, Taranita. That wouldn't make us much of a good talk. So what I really mean, it's all about oneself. It's just that saying it's all about oneself, it's not such a snappy title, is it? So it's all about me. And when I say it's all about oneself, I mean this idea of a self, a relatively fixed, relatively unchanging idea of a self that we tend to construct. But more about that later. So I will do a little bit of recapping. First of all, so we did talk about the evolutionary basis of our response to some of these worldly winds. So in terms of gain and loss, you could see an evolutionary response there as it's an endeavour to acquire things that we want to surround ourselves with, which is good from the point of view of survival, acquiring things and not losing things. Then when we look at praise and criticism, this is related to our status amongst other people, as is, in a slightly different way, respect and disgrace. So again, related to how we respond to other people. And this is important from an evolutionary point of view because it's to do with our security within the group and our access to sexual partners, to procreate, and so on. In terms of pain, pain is very important from an evolutionary point of view because it tells us when we're hurting ourselves, when something's wrong that we need to address. And then pleasure is very important as well because that lets us know when we're getting nutritional food, it's related to procreation and stuff like that. So there's a good evolutionary basis for the worldly winds and why we respond the way we do. From a more dharmic perspective, though, that's probably going to be a bit more useful in terms of Buddhist practice. From a more dharmic point of view, the worldly winds do tend to challenge the idea that we have of this relatively fixed self, relatively discrete, relatively unchanging self, or me, that it's all about. But where is this me that it's all about then? If we look for a type of unchanging essence, a quintessence, you might say, of the individual, what might be called in other systems a soul. If we look for that, you can't find it. It's never been seen, it's never been described or seen or found. So there doesn't seem to be any evidence of that type of eternal essence that relates to an individual. Then we might think of the body. Obviously, you know, if we talk about where we are, Taranita's in the shrine room, we refer to the individual in terms of their body, you know, their bodily position. So the body seems to be related to self. But the body, of course, is continually changing, moment by moment. It changes its entire mass over a period of years. So that's hardly fairly very stable. Not only that, but the body really, when we look at our body, it's, and we think of, you know, this is a human being, it's not really. There are more cells in a human body, or an alleged human body, that are non-human than there are human. There are lots of other different species in and around and on our body. It's more true to say that we're actually a colony of creatures. A bit like one of those Portuguese man of war, you know, those floaty things made up of different animals that cooperate together in a colony. And that's a bit like us, really. I like to listen to Melvin Bragg, Lord Bragg these days, of course, and In Our Time podcast that he does. And he did one on parasites, actually. It was very interesting, somewhat unsettling. And he talked about all the various different organisms that live on us and with us and so on and cooperate and are actually necessary for to our survival. So in short, when we think about our body being our body, it's not really very true. So that's not really us anyway. We might think in terms of memories. After all, we can remember what we did years ago. We have this kind of history, this trail of memories. But we know that memories are unreliable, they're forgotten, and we invent memories as well at times. So that's hardly a strong basis, foundation for a self. And we could think in terms of a continuity of consciousness, a moment-by-moment continuity. You know, I've got some awareness, I've had some sort of consciousness over the last few moments. But then we're asleep, aren't we, sometimes, in deep sleep where we don't have consciousness. We might have an operation where we have no consciousness at all, and we don't cease to exist. We still exist without consciousness, so that can't really be a self either. So in short, it's quite difficult to see any sort of fixed, unchanging, discrete self when we look for it. That being the case, it's not surprising that we feel a bit challenged by the worldly winds, because they have a tendency to undermine this fixed sense of a self, to challenge this fixed sense of a self, which can be a bit unsettling. So it's not surprising then that we tend to try to build up ourselves by acquiring various things, tangible things, or as we've seen, imaginary things as well. It's not surprising that we seek the approval of others to try and shore up our sense of selves. And it's not surprising that we try to resist the change that we see all around us as a result of impermanence. But that gives us great opportunities to practice, because we're always being challenged by these worldly winds, and in examining them, we can hopefully see what's going on. So in a bit more detail then, looking a little bit closer, if we look at gain, for example, our default responses to gain. So we can easily get, it can easily set up an expectation, a greed, when we gain things. So these very successful business people who earn millions of pounds, you don't often hear them say, despite their vast wealth, you don't often hear them say, I don't think I'll have a pay rise this year. I think I've got enough. In fairness, you don't hear me saying that very often either, but that is the way of things, isn't it? It's the more we get, we don't tend to think, oh yeah, I'm fine now, I don't need any more. We tend to want to acquire things to shore up our sense of self. And then in response to loss, we can feel angry and hurt. It can feel like we're actually losing a bit of this self, this relatively fixed, relatively stable self or idea of self that we have. In the response to praise, we can feel overly proud or arrogant. We can have a sense of superiority of ourself. When we're criticized, we can feel threatened or under attack. Again, as if our self is being diminished in some way, it's being attacked in some way. In terms of respect, we can feel that we can end up looking down on other people if we feel we've got a lot of respect, or if we can feel we can have over more deference towards other people than is appropriate. In either case, we're positioning ourself, our alleged self, against all these other selves. And then in the face of disgrace, we can feel hurt, lost, diminished, lonely, ostracized. Again, as if our self has been made an outsider. In response to pleasure, we often seek more pleasure. As Yuval Noah Harari said, or to paraphrase him, the typical human response to pleasure is not contentment, but it's to seek more pleasure. And so we tend to seek, in the face of pleasure, more pleasurable experience for ourself. And then in the face of pain, we can often feel angry and afraid, as if ourself is being threatened unfairly, or the sense of injustice towards ourselves. These worldly winds are blowing us around us pretty much all the time in some way, shape or form. Mostly, you know, to a fairly low extent. But they're there all the time and we're responding all the time. We're being blown around to an extent all the time. I've got a quote now from Tsongkhapa. Tsongkhapa is a Tibetan, or was a Tibetan Buddhist teacher. And I found out that his name actually means Man from Onion Valley. I thought it was rather good. Man from Onion Valley. So I quoted this in the publicity for the talk, and it says, "All worldly activities are as immaterial as chaff. All worldly activities are as immaterial as chaff." And chaff, as you might be aware, it's the stuff they throw out of aeroplanes to try and confuse ground-based radar, but that's not what he was referring to. He was referring to chaff in the sense of the husks and stuff that you get for seeds and grain and that sort of thing. And in traditional societies, you beat up the grain and so on. And then you throw it up in the air. You get a big pan or something like that, and you throw it up in the air, and the wind blows away the chaff, and the kernels land back down in the dish, and so you separate it. So the chaff is of no consequence. It's just blown away in the wind. So that's what he was talking about. I did do it myself the other day. I was trying to remember what I did it for, but it still works in the 21st century. It was for some seeds of some sort. Anyway, Tsongkhapa said, in greater length, "This human existence with its liberties is much more precious than a wish-granting jewel. Obtained just this once, difficult to acquire and easily lost, it passes in a flash like lightning in the sky. Considering how, and realizing that all worldly activities are as immaterial as chaff, you must try to extract its essence at all times, day and night." When you think about all the billions of people that have lived and died, and all their little concerns, like we have about our status and about our little gains and losses and what people said to us and so on and so forth. All those billions of people across all those thousands of years. And of course, it matters not a jolt now, does it, you know, to all those people that have gone. It's of no consequence whatsoever. It's all been blown away like chaff in the wind. But that's not, of course, to say that our actions, our thoughts and our speech, our communication, are of no consequence, because of course they are very great consequence. And they have ethical and therefore karmic consequences for other people. But nevertheless, a lot of our activity, particularly our mental activity, is to do with relatively minor things like our trivial responses to the worldly winds. So you might have had the situation, for example, you wake up, maybe you're in a bad mood, or maybe somebody else is in a bad mood. In either way, maybe you're both in a bad mood. And either way, you end up having a disagreement, which turns into an argument, and you go off to work or whatever it is you do during the day, and ruminate upon what you've said, what they said, what you're going to say, how you were right and they were wrong, and so on and so forth. And it goes over and over in your mind. So I don't know if you've had that experience at all, but... And then you come home and ultimately you make up, didn't you? And it all gets sorted. And my experience of that is afterwards you tend to think, why was I getting so head up with that? It all doesn't matter, does it really now? It's all of little consequence. And yet at that moment, or for that day, it seemed of a lot of consequence. But that's how it tends to be, I suppose. It's the way we tend to operate. And things that were of great consequence to us, let's say 3 years ago, you know, you can't even remember them now. I do like to try and bear that in mind. If something is on my mind and it's concerning me, and think, you know, well, in a month's time, in a year's time, you know, it's not going to be an issue. So it does give us, all this stuff does give us, as Tsongkhapa alluded to, a lot of opportunity to practice day and night, because it's around with us all the time. And we do get kind of woken up out of that sometimes. So we might have... an experience that reminds us and gets it more into perspective. So we might see something on TV, a tragedy of some sort, or maybe we have an illness, or there might be a death close to us, or maybe we have some sort of insight experience, or maybe we're traveling and we see other people much less fortunate than ourselves. And in these situations, it does help to get things in some sort of perspective. But to a large extent, we do seem to be blown around by the worldly winds. So let's just look then now at the suggested false antidotes. So they're on the right-hand side in black. So just a reminder, these are the false antidotes, suggested false antidotes. Things that we might think of doing but probably wouldn't help. Asceticism, a thick skin, individualism and alienation. And they all, to me, when I was thinking about them, reflecting on, they all seem to have a sort of flavour of closure, of closing in, of distancing oneself, of not being in touch, of trying to be the opposite, really, of withdrawing into oneself. Whereas if we look on the right-hand side with the suggested antidotes, we've got their generosity, honesty, individuality and awareness, which have a much more open sense to them, I think, a much more positive, a much more in-touch sense of being with the situation. So that brings me to another quotation. And I should say just before that as well, I think in becoming aware of the worldly winds, just being mindful of them, seeing their actions, then it does give us an opportunity to be aware of the way that we construct and maintain this idea of a fixed self. In fact, it gives us an opportunity to liberate ourselves from that and sail with the worldly winds instead of just being blown about by them. So I've got a quote from Dogen. Dogen was a Japanese Zen practitioner. He's on the refuge tree of our movement. And he was born in Kyoto in 1200. And he said, "To study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things of the universe. To be enlightened by all things of the universe is to cast off the body and mind of the self as well as those of others." Now, Dogen also wrote the Shobogenzo, which is also known as the Treasury of the True Dharma Eye, which is not a straightforward text. But I've got one of the most quoted essays is the Genjo Koan. So I'm going to say go through four paragraphs from the Genjo Koan as it relates to what I've been talking about. So in the first paragraph, he wrote, "As all things are Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization, practice and birth and death, and there are Buddhas and sentient beings." So in here he's saying, this first paragraph, he's saying that there are indeed beings that are realized, Buddhas, and there are ordinary beings as well, like me. And clearly our difficulties can seem real to us, and to that extent, they are real. And this is what motivates us to practice. So in this sense, there is a mundane existence, but we can see something other than a mundane existence. In the second paragraph, he says, "As the myriad things are without an abiding self, there is no delusion, no realization, no Buddha, no sentient beings, no birth and death." So realized beings, Buddhas and so on, may be beyond this idea of self and other. They see in reality that things are not discrete entities. And at the same time, if we could overcome our sense of a self, we could see things as they are, as manifestations of an impermanent continuum of which we are a part. When he talks about discrete entities here, he's talking about basically all phenomena. So we sometimes talk in Buddhism about emptiness, shunyata. Now, trouble with translating a word into English is we've already got an understanding of what that word means in English, and it usually doesn't mean exactly the same thing when we translate it from a Buddhist expression. Emptiness in this sense doesn't mean, unfortunately, doesn't mean being completely empty of something. It means something slightly different. It means empty of three things in particular. And this applies to all phenomena: me, Jvalamalani, the Buddhist Center, Wayne Rooney, rockets, spaceships, the sun, everything. So we are empty of three things in particular. And first of all, we're empty of any substantiality. Now that's to say that there is no fixed, discrete self, as I was talking about earlier. The sort of idea you would talk about in Christianity of a soul. So from a Buddhist perspective, that doesn't exist. If you search for it, it can't be found. So there's no discrete essence. Nor is there a discrete essence of anything else, you know, a mountain, a river, and so on and so forth. For one reason, we're all made up of other bits. And those bits are made up of other bits. So there's no discrete entities. So that's one thing. The second thing is, we're empty of any permanence. We can see now that we all change over a period of time, and so does everything else. You know, buildings fall down. It was really, I think, a remarkable insight of the Buddha to come up with this. Because in those days, you know, you would have seen a mountain range, and your parents would have told you, yes, that mountain range was there when I was little. And your grandparents would have said, you know, yes, that mountain range was there. It hasn't changed, exactly the same. My dad used to tell me about it as well. So from their point of view, certain things didn't appear to change. But of course, we now know that everything changes. Continents, mountains, rise and fall. So for the Buddha to come up with that insight in those days was quite remarkable, really. So we know, really, that nothing is static. So we're empty of permanence, us and everything else. And then finally, we're empty of any complete satisfaction. So there is nothing, I think, that I could give you that would completely satisfy you on an ongoing basis. I might be able to give you something that would satisfy you for a short period of time, you know, a nice new mobile phone, nice banana, something, I don't know. But nothing is going to be satisfy you for any length of time. And I suspect, at least speaking for myself, I suspect even when you are really satisfied with something, I remember when Manchester United won the Champions League in 1999, I was pretty satisfied at that point, but I think there were still bits of me that weren't completely satisfied. In fact, I know there was. I was thinking about next season, where do we go from here then? Anyway, so I think, in short, let's not get sidetracked by the Champions League. In short, we're empty also of any complete satisfaction. So we're empty of those three things. Third paragraph. The Buddha way is basically leaping clear of abundance and lack. Thus, there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas. So initially, when seeking the truth, we can separate ourselves from it. We can see ourselves and we can see, oh, that's spiritual, non-spiritual, spiritual. So we separate ourselves from it. We think, and we should also see things in terms of self and everything else. And then final paragraph, yet in attachment blossoms fall and in aversion weeds spread. So he is talking about, you know, this idea of the worldly winds, the things we like or the things we are drawn towards and the things we're not, the thing we're averse to. So in spite of all this, one is attached to flowers and one is averse to weeds. In seeing this, though, we can transcend it. When we have a deep realization, we may still feel sad and happy as the result of events, and life still has meaning. Life is what it is, but that is all it is. We can gain a wisdom that liberates us from true suffering. So I'll just read those four paragraphs through again. As all things are Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization, practice and birth and death, and there are Buddhas and sentient beings. As the myriad things are without an abiding self, there is no delusion, no realization, no Buddha, no sentient beings, no birth and death. The Buddha way is basically leaping clear of abundance and lack. Thus, there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas. Yet in attachment blossoms fall and in aversion weeds spread. If that seems a little bit paradoxical or gobbledygook, well, you're in good company, really, because it is something of a koan. And as you may be aware, koans are this instrument that are used in some Zen schools of practice. So they're meant to be a paradox or a puzzle or a difficult question. that is posed by a master to a student, and it's difficult to solve. And in particular, it can't really be solved on the intellectual level, which is the whole point, because it forces the student then to break through to another level of understanding of consciousness. A bit like, in a mundane example, you may have, well, I'm a software developer, and so I have had the situation several times where you get stuck on a problem and you try different things, different approaches to try and make it work, and you get stuck, and then you go home, and then you wake up in the middle of the night and suddenly you've got the answer, and you don't know where it's come from, but it's there, you've got the solution. So your conscious mind is not there, but your unconscious mind has been beavering away on this particular problem. And has come up with an answer. And that can be the same. You might have had the similar things with Dharmic questions, for example, or in other questions as well. So in short, our unconscious mind can get to work on things and can make a breakthrough that any amount of simple thinking about won't allow us to do and will take us to another level. So that's the idea of a koan. So hence, they're paradoxical. And that is those words by Dogen are very much reminiscent of the famous line, first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. Which might seem, in terms of help as a practice, it might seem of no good to man or beast, really. But there's a couple of ways it can be looked at. The sort of fairly mundane way of looking at it is, let's say you start to practice and you see, so the mountain is an analogy of the spiritual path. The peak of the mountain is where you're aiming for. That's where liberation is. So seeing the mountain from afar, oh yes, there's liberation, I'll head towards it. You can see the mountain. Then when you start climbing the mountain, you start practicing. You can't actually see the mountain because you're on it. All you can see is you're on a slope. But then when you finally attain what it is you're after, you reach the summit, then you can see once again, aha, I'm on the mountain. So that's one way of looking at it. But there's more Zen ways of looking at it as well. So I've got a quote here from Qingyuan Weixin, who is a Chan practitioner. So Chan is to China what Zen is to Japan. And so he says, before I had studied Chan for 30 years, I saw mountains as mountains and rivers as rivers. When I arrived at a more intimate knowledge, I came to the point where I saw that mountains are not mountains and rivers are not rivers. But now I have got its very substance, I am at rest. For it's just that I see mountains once again as mountains and rivers once again as rivers. So what is he on about? So initially we can see things as concepts, and we did talk about that a bit in previous weeks. We have this idea of things being as they are. I'm a relatively discrete entity that I need to protect, and that you are all other discrete entities. Things like Manchester United or Renault Motor Company or the United Kingdom. You know, we tend to think that they're fairly real, solid, substantial things. Which isn't the truth, which isn't really the case. But for initially, that's how we tend to see things. We see concepts as being real. Then with practice, we can get to see through those concepts. It's not that we disregard them, it's just that we can see them from what they really are. Insubstantial, impermanent, and ultimately unsatisfactory. This can bring us to a paradox, though. Because initially, we learn that to practice Buddhism, you need to be, it's a good idea to be ethical, to treat other people kindly and with generosity and so on. But then you learn that actually, I don't really exist as a discrete entity and neither does Karunavarpi. So what's the point in behaving ethically or kindly or what have you, when really none of us exist in a sense, or at least not in the sense that I thought. We're more of a continuum. It brings us really, it reminded me of these false antidotes, where we can practice for a while and get some appreciation that, yeah, things aren't quite what they seem, you know. Things change over time, they're not discrete, etc., etc. So, you know, we could have an alienated awareness, we could become individualistic, we can develop a thick skin and have a skepticism. So, but we're missing something there. So ultimately, we can reconcile this paradox. We see things as they are, but empty of concepts. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. When we have key insights to the nature of reality, we can dwell in the world of emptiness and the world of form. In the first stage, initially, in the mundane world, we can dwell as if our feet are firmly on the ground. Then in the later stages, as we start to practice, we start to see through the concepts, it can be like our head is in the clouds. But then finally, we learn how to do both. In practice, I think this is much less clear-cut. It's not like you go one stage to another stage to another stage. I think it's all a bit mixed up in reality. You have good days and bad days. In terms of working with the worldly winds then, initially, we're blown about by the worldly winds, seeing them as being relatively real. Somebody praises you, somebody criticizes you. You know, it feels real, like somebody punching you. Then we can begin to see the emptiness of the worldly winds. So they no longer have so much of an effect on us. Then finally, we can sail the worldly winds. We can smile at the praise and smile at the criticism. We see their effects on others, and we can therefore empathize with their suffering. Because to the extent that people feel them, they are real. And we can develop a compassion through an understanding of their true nature. We can develop kind of an appreciation for the worldly winds in the sense of a kind of an understanding of a connection. Finally, realizing that, as they say in the Lego movie, we can realize that everything is awesome. Thank you for listening.